Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Gentlemen, we're talking about the doctrine of God, and we've got to begin at the beginning. How do we know that God exists is the theme of this broadcast. And of course, the question always arises at the beginning of the discussion. If God is transcendent, if God is incomprehensible, how on earth can we even talk about God? How can God be known?
Well, the simplest is in John chapter 1. That is, the incomprehensible God became man. Believers have understood that for centuries. Just read John chapter 1.
Immanuel Kant in the 18th century came along and said that basically God is someone we have to believe in order to have morality, but there's no way of knowing anything about this God. And God was in this realm called the noumenal, the mysterious, unknowable realm, in contrast to the phenomenal realm, the realm of everyday life and existence and history and so forth. But the great announcement, as Rod just mentioned, of John's gospel is that the noumenal became phenomenal.
Yeah.
Of course, Kant was right. We can't know anything about God. We can't know God at all except from what we get in creation, which is that God exists, that he is a designer, that he's wise, that he's glorious, that he's majestic, that he made an awful lot of stuff. But we get nothing about forgiveness of sins and reconciliation with that God.
Nor Holy Trinity.
Or the Holy Trinity. And so we have to have a revelation. And that's exactly what God has done for us in Scripture and supremely, climactically, in the person and work of Christ.
Yeah, Paul says in Romans 1 that although God himself cannot be known other than what he has revealed, but he has clearly revealed in creation something about himself, and that's enough for men to know that he does exist. In fact, in chapter 1, he says, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. So, yes, God cannot, he is incomprehensible in and of himself, but he has chosen to reveal something about himself in creation first.
So the Christian truth claim is the noumenal God becomes phenomenal.
It is a Christian claim. And in many cases, church people aren't trained in that.
Yeah.
Kant becomes like a tank, like facing a German tank, because in the congregation we haven't done this apologetic work.
Yeah, people often think that, I mean, you look at the history of theology, and Schleiermacher, the father of modern liberal theology, comes along and says, well, if we can't know him through our reason, then we can know him through our feeling, our experience.
Well, let's all depend on him.
Yeah, yeah. You ask me how I know he lives within my heart. And
right.
That became the religion of liberalism. And a lot of evangelicals, frankly, today share that view that, okay, I can't know God through reason, but there must be some irrational way of knowing God. And my experience or my morality or my this or my that becomes the way. We've got to remember God has come to us. Paul says God, you don't go pull him down out of the heavens and go into the depths to bring him up. He is as near as the word which we preach, that is the gospel.
Okay. What is the so-called, what are the so-called classical proofs of the existence of God? These have a long history in Christian theology, but they are commonly discussed in reference to the question of the existence of God. What are they, the classical proofs, the so-called proofs?
Well, the unusual one is the ontological argument, and then the more familiar to most of us is the cosmological, in one form or another. There's more than one. And we're most familiar, most lay people, I think, Christians, are familiar with the teleological argument. Those are their names.
What is the how's the ontological argument work?
Oh, man.
I recall a lecture years and years ago when I was a new theology student, and Rod was talking about the ontological argument. And if I recall, you liked it on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and hit it on Tuesday and Thursday.
Yeah.
Is that how that went?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's either brilliant or I'm amazed that I've given 10 minutes time to this. Basically, it turns on the definition that God is that than which none greater can be conceived.
Anselm.
It's Anselm.
Yes.
And then stolen by Descartes without footnotes. He is that than which none greater can be conceived, and then implicitly, it is greater to exist in external reality than it is to exist just as an idea in someone's mind. And the claim is that just from understanding the definition of God, you have proven that he exists not just in your mind as an idea. You have already proven that he exists out there in reality. And if you don't understand how you've just proven it, then Anselm will go through it, how you know that he's out there from just that.
And since we're taping on a Monday, I'm assuming you like it today. You think it's a good idea this morning.
And the problem, of course, with arguments from perfection is that it assumes that we all have a common understanding of what the perfect is, and that we are – that just because we're capable of conceiving it, it must necessarily exist. There are a lot of leaps. It seems to me there are a lot of leaps, not in logic, but leaps in developing his argument. It's not a very Loctite argument, and of course Descartes always thought that his arguments were Loctite.
This one of all claims, because it doesn't depend on anything that comes into your eyeballs or earballs, that it's just conceptual, that you really can prove that God exists. Basically, it's this. If you can arrive at the concept of a God who has all the attributes that we're going to discuss during this program, except that he doesn't is, then, says the arguer, well, there's a greater God that can be conceived.
Because he is.
He would have all those attributes, and he would is.
Of all of the classical arguments, this is the one that I get most frustrated with, because at least the teleological argument, which is the argument from design, all these people talking about intelligent design, they're arguing a version of that teleological argument. The cosmological argument, how'd this all get here? Well, it must have been God. Those are arguments that in their sort of most basic expression, the person on the street assumes. And you don't have to be a philosopher to work through those things.
Right.
One of my problems with the ontological argument is it's the sort of thing that would make sense only to an introspective, solipsistic philosopher. Right. When you read the Bible, you don't learn very much about God's innards. You don't learn very much about what's going on inside of God's mind. When you read even Augustine and some of our folks, you get the impression that they can take you into God's mind and the inner workings. The Bible doesn't do that. The Bible leads us by the hand to what God has done in history: creation, providence, redemption, consummation. Those are the biblical categories.
Okay. How does the cosmological argument work?
Well, the most common form of it is if there weren't a God, there wouldn't be anything at all. That's the most basic one. There are other forms of it, but that's the way you usually hear it. And if it's argued on the street, somebody says, well, the Big Bang or this explosion of hydrogen, and the Christian is instructed to say back to that, well, where did the hydrogen come from? That's the most basic. If there weren't a God, there wouldn't be anything.
Contingency arguments, then.
Well, contingency really is a way of rolling them all into one. But just the cosmological, at its most basic level, is if there weren't a creator, there wouldn't be anything.
Yeah,
now, it used to be that the answer given to that was that matter is eternal. It always has been and always will be. Given what contemporary physics tells us, that's harder to say.
So the fact of the creation is the fact of the it points to the creator.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the refutation of that argument from the atheist or unbeliever is that's going to end up in an infinite regress. Who made this? Who made that? You don't really know that God is the author. You only know that it was caused somehow. But you really don't know that this person is God.
What about teleological arguments?
Well, that was the one that drew me out of agnosticism back to theism. It was a comfortable theism because it had no morals to it. But when I was an agnostic at the University of Washington, I became a theist not by Christians talking to me, but by being in a class in vertebrate embryology. And in there, as we looked at the serial sections of a fetal pig, one of the things that we learned was that in the gestation period of a pig, there were only 6 hours when certain folds of tissue had to fold certain ways or there'd be no central nervous system in the pig. Now, I knew a little bit about mathematics. And I said, now that means that there's a designer behind this. Well, while other guys were having dates, I smelled like formaldehyde from dissecting things and couldn't get one.
We were going to bring that up, Rod, actually. This morning, I was going to ask if you had bacon and eggs.
I thought that was brute. Just a little formaldehyde behind the ears there.
But that does sort of take the cosmological argument to the next step, because it looks at that which exists and takes it beyond its mere existence,
right,
supposes or presupposes a purpose.
Now, even Kant was impressed with this, jerk that he was. He ended up saying, two things never cease to amaze me, the starry heavens above and the moral law within.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Even
right.
after he had dumped all knowledge of God out the front door and yanked it back in through the back door through morals, he still said that, two things never cease to amaze me.
Mm-hmm. What are the strengths and weaknesses of these things? Reformation folk tend to have a less robust view of the classical proofs. Is that fair to say, than
yes.
someone in, say, the rigid Thomistic tradition?
I think if you'd asked the Reformation folk, they probably would have said, yes, it won't get you as far as you imagine, but we're not against them. In the case of the teleological argument, the grand designer of it all, the thing that stands massively in front of it is the problem of evil.
Yeah, yeah.
Your grand designer, David Hume's great line was, if God did create this world, one hopes that he was only practicing and next time he'll do better.
Calvin saw those arguments in his day, and that's one of the reasons he said, the kind of knowledge that we're looking for and that these proofs do not provide is a knowledge of God as our Redeemer.
Yep.
Yep.
And Calvin says, we're going to talk about these proofs. Okay, but let's hurry on.
Yes.
Let's not stay here for very long,
yes.
because he says it'll only drive us further from God, because the more we know about God as if we were never fallen, the more, because we are fallen, the more we do hear about God and learn about God, the more contemptible he is in our sight. And what we really need to hear is what God has done in Jesus Christ to save us. Otherwise, his justice and his purity and his pure majesty and all of this stuff is just going to drive us crazy.
Right on. And the Reformers knew that built into us was anything that we could discuss God apart from Christ and his cross. And we are. Luther used to say the old Adam is a Schwärmer. Or you could switch it and you could say the old Adam is a philosopher who wants to talk about God's existence.
Mm-hmm.
That is, we will be drawn to what is away from Christ.
Right.
Yep.
So we've got Aristotle's prime mover, but not the God of the Bible.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
that's exactly what I think both of our traditions have really emphasized, that when you get to the end, you know, Thomas Aquinas says, and this being we call God. Well, no, I don't believe in God. I believe in Yahweh, who has covenanted with his people to send the Messiah to crush the serpent's head and to redeem his people, take them through the waters of judgment to everlasting rest. That's a story I'm telling about what God has done and is doing and will do in history. That's not a sort of timeless meditation on an eternal truth that's a little bit more speculative.
Yeah, that's a very important point. Well, let's ask the $64 question then. At the end of the day, when all of this is said and done, can we really prove to somebody that God exists?
It's a funny thing in English. You got to back up to what do you mean by prove. If we mean in a 100% apodictic way, the answer is no. And it's a good thing, as Wittgenstein, the philosopher, knew. If you could do that, he would have to be empty of content.
So this is not like doing Euclidean geometry.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But if by proof we mean by the seat of our pants, common sense as we know the external world, I think the answer is yes, but it's through Christ, not through these.
One thing, too, I think, you just look at the way Paul talks about it in Romans 1 and 2, and it is striking that Paul doesn't say, here are some really good arguments to convince atheists that God exists. He says, hey, let's just start from the assumption, the realization that we all believe that God exists. That's why you get idolatry. That's why you get people worshiping God in the form of creeping things and animals and so forth. It's not that human atheism, Paul says, is never the human problem. The human problem is projecting any God you like. Idolatry is the problem, Paul is saying. He doesn't start out with the premise that people don't believe in God. He starts out with a premise that people know that there is a God, but they twist and distort that so that they can go on living in rebellion against him.
So the case is basically that atheism isn't so much rational as it is moral.
Well, I think you could say that, but I don't like the company that I'm traveling with when I say that. It is very common in evangelical circles to be taught that every problem is a pseudo-problem that's hiding a moral one. I don't think that's the route to take. I think it's a better route to take when we read in the text that as children of Adam, we are opposed to the God who really is and will take anything to avoid him.
So actually, we're dealing with two issues. One, by our sinful nature, we are limited in what we can know. So even that which is revealed is somewhat marred because of sin.
Sure.
But secondly, we are, as Paul says in Romans 1, actively suppressing what is known.
Right. And one of the most frightening lines in all the Bible is in those early chapters of Romans where Paul says, before he talks about idolatry / homosexuality, he says, and they press down the truth in unrighteousness.
Suppress
the truth in unrighteousness.
It's like stepping on a cigarette butt. It's the Greek is, you know, and they press down the truth in unrighteousness. And that's a possibility.
I didn't know they had cigarette butts in Athens. Been smoking a long time, haven't they? If the case then for the existence of God is so strong, and I think it's clear that we're all under the general agreement that it is, the problem is people suppress the truth in unrighteousness. If the question is so strong, then the reason why people don't believe in God isn't that there is not sufficient evidence to believe in God. It's that people don't want to believe in God.
Yeah, and the passages we've been quoting more than any other here are Romans chapter 1 and Romans chapter 2.
Yeah.
If you've never read those, it's worth taking a look at them.
I don't go all the way in accepting what's called Reformed epistemology, Alvin Plantinga and company, but I do think the point that they make here is very good, and they take this point from Calvin. Basically, to tell a person you have to prove the existence of God before you can believe in the existence of God is similar to saying that you have to prove the existence of your wife before you can believe in your wife. There are lots of things that we just believe in, and we don't have to take a bunch of time out of our life to prove, because if we didn't believe in them, we would be nuts. We would be people who just didn't operate according to our cognitive design. Married people who don't believe that their spouse exists tend to be locked up in facilities.
We have homes for them.
And that's why
keep
I
them safe.
Exactly. That's why I say again in Romans 1 and 2, Paul doesn't do that. He doesn't set out to prove, though he could. And Calvin says the same thing in the Institutes. I could set out right now to prove the existence of God. And I'm not saying that proofs are necessarily bad or evidences. But I'm going to start here because I really do believe that people believe in God.
Why the Christian God?
Well, there you're arguing from the incarnation. And the part that's really offensive to our culture today is that the way the New Testament reads, the way to God is only through Jesus. Read John's Gospel just once and you'll find out that it is not Baha'i, you know, a pantheon of equal gods. There's the part that gets to our culture. It isn't just that God has become flesh in Jesus, and that's available to your knowledge through the writings of those who are there, but that it's exclusive.
Mm-hmm. So you're not going to go on Oprah and say, I think God is like...
One of our guys did, but that's another subject.
Yeah, it's the problem today is not only that it's only Jesus, but even a hierarchy they wouldn't deal with. At least in old liberalism, you know, you had Jesus at the top of the Christmas tree.
Right.
Now you can't even have you can't even have that. Any normative truth claims are out the door, but that's no different from the first century Christians.
Sure.
Well, what do we do in this culture where we're under so much pressure as Christian believers to be forced to acknowledge that the Christian God is the same as the God of Islam and the God of Judaism?
I would say, ironically, just first of all, go to your congregation on Sunday morning and have a pastor who follows the liturgical script. And keep doing it. That is, our culture is so adrift that if anybody even notices they want to find something that claims to be really true or what Schaeffer calls true truth, if you're doing your worship service faithful to your hymnal on Sunday morning, that will stand out.
What people need to realize too, I think, is that Jesus Christ is not just the way to the Father. He is that, but in John's Gospel, where that is said, a lot of other stuff is said. He isn't just an instrument, a means to an end. So you have people saying, well, I believe that Jesus is the only way, but the God of Islam is the God imperfectly understood of Islam, is the God of Christianity and so forth. No, Jesus is not just the revealer of God. Jesus is not just the way to God. Jesus is not just the channel. Mm-hmm. Jesus is God. Mm-hmm. If you want any contact with God at all, Jesus is your man.
Yeah.
Jesus is God in the flesh. And if you want any other, if you want to talk about any other kind of God, you're talking about the devil.
Well, Mike, I just can't wait to see your invitation to Oprah.
but I think, again, when we talk about these other religions, Allah, because that comes up all the time. How can we say that the Muslims are worshiping the same God, they just call him by a different name? Conceptually, they are saying they are attempting to define the same God, but as Paul says, they are suppressing that God. And they and what we are doing, what Christians, when we try to say, well, yeah, there's room for that, what we're doing is actually missing something more fundamental, and that is the suppression of the true God ends up being the wrong God.
Yeah.
And so as you pointed out, Mike, we cannot say, well, it's the same God, we just use different names, because the God of the Bible and the God of Christianity was conceived of a woman. And that is the same. And so it's more than just saying, well, the difference is the God of the Bible, he has a son named Jesus. But that son named Jesus is the God.
Right. Yeah.
And we can't miss that.
It really is a unique claim, as you guys point out.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about supporting our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also visit us online at whitehorsein.org. That's whitehorsein.org.